Welcome to Reading the Classics on KRBD. I'm Kelly Johnson with the Ketchikan Public Library, and this evening I'll be reading Lectures on Astronomy by John Phoenix. Introductory. The following pages were originally prepared in the form of a course of lectures to be delivered before the Lowell Institute of Boston, Massachusetts. But owing to the unexpected circumstance of the authors receiving no invitation to lecture before that institution, they were laid aside shortly after their completion. Receiving an invitation from the trustees of the Valectos Literary and Scientific Institute during the present summer to deliver a course of lectures on any popular subject, the author withdrew his manuscript from the dusty shelf on which it had long lain neglected, and, having somewhat revised and enlarged it to suit the capacity of the eminent scholars before whom it was to be displayed, repaired to Valectus. However, on arriving at that place, he learned with deep regret that the only inhabitant had left a few days previously, having availed himself of the opportunity presented by a passing emigrant's horse, and that, in consequence, the opening of the Institute was indefinitely postponed. Under these circumstances, and yielding with reluctance to the earnest solicitations of many eminent scientific friends, he has been induced to place the lectures before the public in their present form. Should they meet with that success which his sanguine friends prognosticate, the author may be induced subsequently to publish them in the form of a textbook for the use of higher schools and university, it being his greatest ambition to render himself useful in his day and generation by widely disseminating the information he has acquired among those who, less fortunate, are yet willing to receive instruction. John Phoenix, San Diego Observatory, September 1st, 1854. Lectures on Astronomy, Part 1, Chapter 1. The term astronomy is derived from two Latin words, astra, a star, and onomy, a science, and literally means the science of the stars. It is a science, to quote our friend Dick, who has no relation at all to Big Dick, though the latter occasionally caused individuals to see stars, which has in all ages engaged the attention of the poet, the philosopher, and the divine, and been the subject of their study and admiration. By the wondrous discoveries of the improved telescopes of modern times, we ascertain that upward of several hundred million stars exist, that are invisible to the naked eye, the nearest of which is millions of miles from the earth. And, as we have ever reason to suppose that every one this inconceivable number of worlds is peopled like our own, a consideration of this fact, and that we are undoubtedly as superior to these beings as we are to the rest of mankind, is calculated to fill the mind of the American with a due sense of his own importance in the scale of animated creation. It is supposed that each of the stars we see in the heavens in a cloudless night is a sun shining upon its own curvilinear with light of its own manufacture, and as it would be absurd to suppose its light and heat were made to be diffused for nothing, it is presumed further that each sun, like an old hen, is provided with a parcel of little chickens, in the way of planets, which, shining but feebly by its self-reflected light, are unto us invisible. In this opinion we are led, also by reason from analogy, on considering our own solar system. The solar system is so called not because we believe it to be the sole system of the kind in existence, but from its principal body, the sun, the Latin name of which is Sol. Thus we read of Sol Smith, literally meaning the son of old Smith. On close examination of the heavens, we perceive numerous brilliant stars which shine with steady light, differing from those which surround them, which are always twinkling like a dewdrop on a cucumber vine, and which, moreover, do not preserve constantly the same relative distance from the stars near which they are first discovered. These are the planets of the solar system, which have no light of their own, of which the earth on which we reside is one, which shine by light reflected from the sun, and which regularly move around that body at different intervals of time and through different ranges in space. Up to the time of a gentleman named Copernicus, who flourished about the middle of the 15th century, it was supposed by our stupid ancestors that the earth was the center of all creation, being a large flat body resting on a rock, which rested on another rock, and so on all the way down. And that the sun, planets, and immovable stars all revolved about it once in every 24 hours. This reminds us of the simplicity of a child we once saw in a railroad car who fancied itself perfectly stationary and thought the fences, houses, and fields were tearing past it at the rate of 30 miles an hour, and poking out its head to see where on earth they went to, had its hat, a very nice one with pink ribbons, knocked off and irrevocably lost. But Copernicus, who was the son of Daniel Pernius of the firm Pernius and Company, wool dealers, and who was named Copernicus out of respect to his father's partners, soon set this matter to rights and started the idea of the present solar system, which, greatly improved since his day, is occasionally called the Copernican system. By this system, we learn that the sun is stationed at one focus, not hocus as it is rendered without authority by the philosopher Parrington, of an ellipse where it slowly grinds on forever about its own axis, while the planets, turning about their axes, revolve in elliptical orbits of various dimension and different planes of inclination around it. The demonstration of the system in all its perfection was left to Sir Isaac Newton, an English philosopher who, seeing an apple tumble down from a tree, was led to think thereon with such gravity that he finally discovered the attraction of gravitation, which proved to be the great law of nature that keeps everything in its place. Thus we see that as an apple originally brought sin and ignorance to the world, the same fruit provided thereafter the cause of vast knowledge and enlightenment. And indeed, we may doubt whether any of the fruit but an apple, and a sour one at that, would have produced these great results. For had the fallen fruit been a pear, an orange, or peach, there is little doubt that Newton would have just eaten it up and thought no more on the subject. As in this world, you will hardly ever find a man so small but that he has someone else smaller than he to look up to and revolve around him, so in the solar system we find that the majority of the planets have one or more smaller planets revolving about them. These small bodies are termed secondaries, moons, or satellites, the planets themselves being called primaries. We know at present of 18 primaries, including Mercury, Venus, the Earth, Mars, Flora, Vesta, Iris, Metis, Hebe, Astrea, Juno, Ceres, Pallas, Hygieia, Jupiter, Saturn, Herschel, Neptune, and another yet unnamed. They are distributed among these 19 secondaries, all of which, except our moon, are invisible to the naked eye. We shall now proceed to consider separately the different bodies composing the solar system, and to make known what little information, comparatively speaking, science has collected regarding them. And first in order, as in place, we come to the sun. This glorious orb may be seen almost any clear day by looking intently in its direction through a piece of smoked glass, though this medium, it appears about the size of a large orange and much of the same color. It is, however, somewhat larger, being in fact 887,000 miles in diameter and containing a volume of matter equal to 1,400,000 globes of the size of the Earth, which is certainly a matter of no small importance. Through the telescope, it appears like an enormous globe of fire with many spots upon the surface, which, unlike those of a leopard, are continually changing. These spots were first discovered by a gentleman named Galileo in the year 1611. Though the sun is usually termed and considered the luminary of day, it may not be uninteresting to our readers to know that it certainly has been seen in the night. A scientific friend of ours from New England, Mr. R.W. Emerson, while traveling through the northern part of Norway with a cargo of tinware on the 21st of June, 1836, distinctly saw the sun in all its majesty shining at midnight. In fact, shining all night. Emerson is not what you would call a superstitious man by any means, but he left. Since that time, many persons have observed its nocturnal appearance in that part of the country, at that same time of year. This phenomenon has never been witnessed in the latitude of San Diego, however, and it is very improbable that it ever will be. Sacred history informs us that a distinguished military man named Joshua once called the sun to stand still. How he did it is not mentioned. There can, of course, be no doubt of the fact that he arrested its progress and possibly caused it to stand still, but translators are not always perfectly accurate, and we are inclined to the opinion that it might have wiggled a very little when Joshua was not looking directly at it. The statement, however, does not appear so very incredible when we reflect that the seafaring men are in the habit of actually bringing the sun down to the horizon every day at 12 meridian. This they effect by the means of a tool made of brass, glass, and silver called a sextant. The composition of the sun has long been a matter of dispute. By close and accurate observation with an excellent opera glass, we have arrived at the conclusion that its entire surface is covered with water to a very great depth, which water, being composed by a process known at present only to the creator of the universe and Mr. Payne of Worcester, Massachusetts, generates carbureted hydrogen gas, which, being in flame, surrounds the entire body with an ocean of fire, from which we and the other planets receive our light and heat. The spots upon its surface are glimpses of water obtained through the fire, and we call the attention of our old friend and former schoolmate, Mr. Agassiz, to this fact, as by closely observing one of these spots with a strong refracting telescope, he may discover a new species of fish, with little fishes inside of them. It is possible that the sun may burn out after a while, which would leave this world in a state of darkness quite uncomfortable to contemplate. But even under these circumstances, it is pleasant to reflect that courting and lovemaking would probably increase to an indefinite extent, and that many persons would make large fortunes by the sudden rise in the value of coal, wood, candles, and gas, which would go to illustrate the truth of that old proverb, "It's an ill wind that blows nobody any good." Upon the whole, the sun is a glorious creation, pleasing to gaze upon through smoked glass, elevating to think upon, and exceedingly comfortable to every created being on a cold day. It is the largest, the brightest, and may be considered by far the most magnificent object in the celestial sphere, though with all these attributes, it must be confessed that it is occasionally entirely eclipsed by the moon. Chapter 2. We shall now proceed to the consideration of the several planets. Mercury. This planet, with the exception of the asteroids, is the smallest of the system. It is the nearest to the sun and, in consequence, cannot be seen on account of the sun's superior light, except at its greatest eastern and western elongations, which occur in March and April, August and September, when it may be seen for a short time immediately after sunset and shortly before sunrise. It then appears like a star of the first magnitude, having white twinkling light and resembling somewhat the star Regulus in the constellation Leo. The day in Mercury is about 10 minutes longer than ours, its year about equal to 3 of our months. It receives 6.5 times as much heat from the sun as we do, from which we conclude that the climate must be very similar to that of Fort Yuma on the Colorado River. The difficulty of communication with Mercury will probably prevent its ever being selected as a military post, though it possesses many advantages for that purpose, being extremely inaccessible, inconvenient, and doubtlessly singularly uncomfortable. It receives its name from the god Mercury in the heathen mythology, who is the patron and tutelary of divinity of San Diego County. Venus. This beautiful planet may be seen either a little after sunset or shortly before sunrise, according as it becomes the morning or the evening star, but never departing quite 48 degrees from the sun. Its day is about 25 minutes shorter than ours, its year 7.5 months or 32 weeks. The diameter of Venus is 7,700 miles, and she receives from the sun thrice as much light and heat as the Earth. An old Dutchman named Schroeder spent more than 10 years in observation on this planet and finally discovered a mountain on it, 22 miles in height, but he could never discover anything on the mountain, not even a mouse, and he finally died about as wise as when he commenced his studies. Venus, in mythology, was a goddess of singular beauty who became the wife of Vulcan, the blacksmith, and we regret to add, behaved in the most immoral manner after her marriage. The celebrated case of Vulcan versus Mars and the consequent scandal is probably still fresh in the minds of our readers. By a large portion of society, however, she was considered an ill-used and persecuted lady against whose high tone of morals and strict virtuous conduct not a shadow of suspicion could be cast. Vulcan, by the same parties, was considered a horrid brute, and they all agreed that it served him right when he lost his case and had to pay the cost of court. Venus still remains the goddess of beauty, and not a few of her protégés may be found in California. The Earth. Earth, or as the Latins called it, Tellus, from which originated the expression do tellus, is the third planet in the solar system, and the one on which we subsist, with all our important joys and sorrows. The San Diego Herald is published weekly on this planet for $5 per annum, payable invariably in advance, as the Earth is by no means the most important planet in the system. There is no reason to suppose that it is particularly distinguished from the others by being inhabited. It is reasonable, therefore, to conclude that all the other planets of the system are filled with living, moving, and sentient beings, and as some of them are superior to the Earth in size and position, it is not improbable that their inhabitants may be superior to us in physical and mental organization. But if this were a demonstrable fact instead of a mere hypothesis, it would be found a very difficult matter to persuade us of its truth. To the inhabitants of Venus, the Earth appear like a brilliant star, very much, in fact, as Venus appears to us. And, reasoning from anthology, we are led to believe that the election of Mr. Pierce, the European War, or the split in the great Democratic Party, produced but very little excitement among them. To the inhabitants of Jupiter, our important globe appears like a small star of the fourth or fifth magnitude. We recollect some years ago gazing with astonishment upon the inhabitants of a drop of water developed by a solar microscope and secretly wondering whether they were or not reasoning beings with souls to be saved. It is not altogether a pleasant reflection that a highly scientific inhabitant of Jupiter, armed with a telescope of, to us, inconceivable form, may be pursuing a similar course of inquiry and indulging in similar speculation regarding our Earth and its inhabitants. Gazing with curious eyes, his attention is suddenly attracted by the movements of a grand celebration of 4th of July in New York, or a mighty convention in Baltimore. "Bless my soul," he exclaims, "I declare they're alive. These little creatures, they do seem them to wriggle." To an inhabitant of the sun, however, he of Jupiter is probably quite as insignificant, and the sun man is possibly a mere atom in the opinion of a dweller in Sirius. A little reflection on these subjects leads to the opinion that the death of an individual man on this earth, though perhaps as important an event as can occur to himself, is calculated to cause no great convulsion of nature or disturb particularly the great aggregate of created beings. The earth moves round the sun from west to east in a year and turns on its axis in a day, thus moving at the rate of 68,000 miles an hour in its orbit and rolling around at the tolerably rapid rate of 1,040 miles per hour. As our readers may have seen that when a man is galloping on a horse violently over a smooth road, if the horse from viciousness or other cause suddenly stops, the man keeps on at the same rate over the animal's head. So we, supposing Earth to be suddenly arrested on its axis, men, women, children, horses, cattle, and sheep, donkeys, editors, and members of Congress, with all our goods and chattels, would be thrown off in the air at a speed of 173 miles a minute. Every mother's son of us describing the arc of parabola, which is probably the only description we should ever be able to give of this affair. This catastrophe, to one sufficiently collected to enjoy it, would doubtless be exceedingly amusing, but as there would probably be no time for laughing, we pray that it may not occur until after our demise, when, should it take place, our moment will probably accompany the movement. It is a singular fact that if man travel round the earth in an eastwardly direction, he will find, on returning to the place of departure, he has gained one whole day. The reverse of this proposition also being true. It follows that the Yankees, who are constantly traveling to the west, do not live as long by a day or two as they would if they had stayed home. And supposing each Yankee's time to be worth $1.50 per day, it may be easily shown that a considerable amount of money is annually lost by their roving dispositions. Science is yet but in infancy. With its growth, new discoveries of astounding nature will doubtless be made, among which probably will be some method by which the course of the earth may be altered, and it be steered with the same ease and regularity through space and among the stars as the steamboat is now directed through the water. It will be a very interesting spectacle to see the earth rounding to, with her head in the air, off Jupiter, while the moon is set off laden with mails and passengers for that planet, to bring back the return mails and a large party of rowdy Jupiterarians going to attend a grand prize fight in the ring of Saturn. Well, Christopher Columbus would have been just as much astonished at a revelation of the steamboat and the locomotive engine, as we should be witness to the above performance, which our intelligent posterity, during the ensuing year, A.D. 2000, will possibly look upon as a very ordinary and commonplace affair. Only 3 days ago, we asked a medium where Sir John Franklin was at that time, to which he replied he was cruising about, officer and crew as well, on the interior of the earth, to which he obtained entrance through a Sims hole. With few remarks upon the earth's satellite, we conclude the first lecture on astronomy and the remainder of the course being contained on a second lecture treating the planets Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and the asteroids and fixed stars, last being fixings, are according Mr. Charles Dickens' American property, the moon. This resplendent luminary, like a youth on the 4th of July, has its first quarter like a ruined spendthrift in its last corner, and, like an omnibus, is occasionally full and new. The evenings on which it appears between these last stages are beautifully illuminated by its clear, mellow light. The moon resolves an elliptical orbit about the earth in 29 days, 12 hours, 44 minutes, and 3 seconds, the time which elapses between one new moon and another. It was supposed by the ancient philosophers that the moon was made of green cheese, an opinion still entertained by the credulous and ignorant. Kepler and Tycho Brahe, however, held on to the opinion it was composed of charlotte russe, a dark portions of its surface being sponge cake, the light blancmange. Modern advances in science and the use of the Lord Rosse's famous telescope have demonstrated the absurdity of all these speculations by proving conclusively that the moon is mainly composed of the ferrosesquicernate of the cyanide of potassium. Up to the latest dates from the Atlantic states, no one has succeeded in reaching the moon. Should anyone do hereafter, it will probably be a woman, as the sex will never cease making an exertion for that purpose as long as there is a man in it. Upon the whole, we may consider the moon an excellent institution, among the many we enjoy under a free republican form of government. And it is a blessed thing to reflect that the President of the United States cannot veto it, no matter how strong an inclination he may feel from principle or habit to do so. It has been ascertained beyond a doubt that the moon has no air. Consequently, the common expression, "the moon was gazing down with an air of benevolence," or "with an air of complacency," or "with an air of calm superiority," are incorrect and objectionable. The fact being that the moon has no air at all. The existence of the celebrated man in the moon has been frequently questioned by modern philosophers. The whole subject is involved in doubt and obscurity. The only authority we have for believing that such an individual exists and has been seen and spoken with is a fragment of an old poem composed by an ancient astronomer of the name of Goose, which has been handed down to us as follows. The man in the moon came down too soon to inquire the way to Norwich. The man in the south, he burned his mouth, eating cold hot porridge. The evidence conveyed in this distich is, however, rejected by the skeptical among modern astronomers who consider the passage an allegory, the man in the south being supposed typical of the late John C. Calhoun, and the cold hot porridge alluded to the project of nullification. End of lecture first.
By the Meadow Gate by Kate Chopin. Over the hill and across the ford and down by the meadow gate, a girl is asleep in the long, cool grass. The soft wind blows and the soft wind passes. The birds call awake, but they do not stay, while the maid is dreaming the time away by the meadow gate. Over the hill and across the ford and down by the meadow gate, a youth with the light of the boundless sky, a glow in his soul and a flame in his eyes, follows the voice that is never still, trading the path to the distant hill by the meadow gate. Over the hill and across the ford and down by the meadow gate, the voice and the dream are so near, that if he but listen, his heart might hear. Now he may follow the years and afar. He may walk from the world to the evening star, past the meadow gate, over the hill and across the ford, and down by the meadow gate. May her days be many, may her days be few. The dream of the maiden will never come true, for the soft wind carried the moment away, and the birds they sang, but they would not stay by the meadow gate.
Thank you for listening to Reading the Classics. I hope you have a lovely evening. Good night.